The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we dive right into the September 13th, 2013 edition of The Week magazine with the main stories and how they were covered. Obama hands decision on Syria to Congress. What happened? In a surprising high-stakes gamble, President Obama has asked Congress for approval of a punitive military strike on Syrian dictator Bashar al-Assad's regime, a vote whose outcome looked very uncertain this week. Key Republicans, including Senators John McCain and Lindsey Graham and House Speaker John Boehner, announced their support for a strike, saying that Assad must be punished for an August 21st sarin gas attack that killed more than 1,400 civilians. If he were allowed to violate international prohibitions on chemical weapons, they said, it would embolden Iran, North Korea, and other rogue nations. The use of these weapons has to be responded to, and only the U.S. has the capability, said Boehner. But various polls show that about 60% of Americans oppose U.S. military intervention, and many House members, including Tea Party Republicans and some liberal Democrats, appeared likely to vote against the resolution when Congress votes, perhaps next week. It is not time for Americans to be subjected to the potential of yet another unwinnable overseas war, said Representative Brian Higgins, Democrat of New York. Obama said he had the authority to order the strike on his own, but that the country would be stronger and our actions will be even more effective if the U.S. government were united behind the strike. He described the planned attack as a shot across the bow. But McCain said that during talks in the White House, Obama discussed a more extensive operation that would change the momentum on the ground in Syria toward the rebels, indicating a broader attack on Assad's air force and other military assets. What the editorials said. Obama made the right call, said the Denver Post. The Constitution clearly bestows the power to declare war on Congress, and a military strike on Syria is an indisputable act of war. There are many risks associated with intervening in Syria, and it's vital that our elected representatives take part in a real debate about whether to go down that road. This will go down as one of the stranger gambles, if not abdications, in commander-in-chief history, said the Wall Street Journal. In the days following the August atrocity, administration officials repeatedly said the president was preparing to take action. Then last week, Obama stunned his aides by punting the issue to Congress. So much for the surprise factor, said the Boston Herald. Thanks to Obama's inept dithering, the Assad regime has been given 2 weeks to hide its artillery, tanks, and planes in densely populated areas. What the columnist said. Obama's handling of Syria has been a case study in how not to do foreign policy, said Fareed Zakaria in CNN.com. From the start, he wanted no part of the country's sectarian civil war. But to look tough, Obama announced 2 years ago that Assad must go, and last year warned Assad that the use of chemical weapons would cross a red line. Those ill-considered words painted Obama into a corner, and to duck responsibility for the consequences, he's asked Congress to take a vote. The president's vacillation on Syria has wrecked America's credibility, said Elliot Abrams in Politico.com. Who in Moscow Beijing, or Tehran will now think this president is a leader who must be feared. Obama's monumental gamble will pay off in the long run, said Fred Kaplan in Slate.com. If he had simply ordered an attack, Republicans would snipe at him relentlessly for doing too little and for doing too much. Now, however, Congress has to commit to any intervention, giving Obama a freer hand. It's entirely possible, however, that Obama will lose in the GOP-controlled House, said Josh Krawshire in NationalJournal.com. Congressmen facing tough elections in swing districts are acutely aware that voting for an attack would cost them votes from war-weary constituents. Factor in the incentives to oppose Obama at all costs, and a rising tide of libertarianism in the GOP, and it's hard to see a majority of Republicans supporting the president. If the House votes no, Obama's presidency will be badly damaged. Second main story, crisis at Fukushima. The Japanese government said this week it was taking over the cleanup effort at the crippled Fukushima nuclear plant amid disturbing reports that new leaks are allowing highly radioactive water to flow into the Pacific Ocean. Since the March 2011 earthquake and tsunami caused a massive nuclear core meltdown, the utility TEPCO has been unable to contain the contamination. This week, it admitted that that radiation levels near one leaky tank were 18 times higher than previously recorded, and intense enough to kill a person in 4 hours. In what Prime Minister Shinzo Abe called a fundamental solution to the problem of contaminated water, the government said it would build a mile-long subterranean ice wall around the reactor cores. It sounds like a crazy last-ditch gambit, said Josh Zizia in thedailybeast.com. Yet it could work. Ice walls have been used for decades to protect mines from flooding. At Fukushima, pipes filled with supercooled liquids will be sunk to depths of 100 feet to freeze the earth and prevent the radioactive water from contaminating groundwater. The resulting wall will be self-healing. Whenever the soil shifts and a crack forms in the wall, any water that flows in or out will freeze, plugging the leak. But it will need to be maintained for years. Yet, how far is the government prepared to go? Asked Fred Voriak and Mary Iwata in the Wall Street Journal. Until now, it has refused to devote the tens of billions of taxpayer dollars that would be needed to fix this mess. Instead, it blamed TEPCO, and even now it has committed only to the ice walls, insisting that the utility be responsible for replacing the leaky tanks. That's disturbing, because TEPCO has shown a frightening level of amateurism, said Michael Schneider in CNN.com. It only found the most recent leak after someone noticed water on the floor. What passes for inspection is two workers walking around to visually scrutinize 1,000 tanks in 2 hours. Cooling three molten reactant cores and five spent fuel pools in a disaster zone is a job of titanic proportions, and TEPCO should never have had to face it alone. The government has shown a pattern of denial since the disaster began. An ice wall alone may not be enough to break it. Turn now to the briefing section. Chemical warfare. For a century, world leaders have tried to ban poison gases from the battlefield. Why are chemical weapons taboo? How long have poisonous weapons been used? For more than 2,000 years. As early as 600 BC, the Athenians poisoned the wells of the Spartans, who later tried lobbing burning sulfur pitch over the walls of Athens, hoping to fill the city with toxic smoke. Genghis Khan used that same trick, catapulting burning sulfur pitch during his siege of fortified cities around AD 1200. Over the centuries, various armies put poisons on arrows and in bullets to make them more lethal. But it wasn't until the 19th and 20th centuries that mankind began developing toxins and poison gases of devastating lethality, including mustard gas, chlorine, and the nerve gas sarin. Even before these gases were used in war, they created a special kind of fear and moral revulsion. What makes these weapons different? In a literal sense, they're not, since the goal of warfare is to kill lots of people in an efficient way. Bombs, missiles, and other munitions achieve very similar results, especially when dropped on civilian areas. But chemical weapons evoke a strong emotional response, perhaps because they can be invisible, and victims often suffer slow and agonizing deaths, convulsing and gasping for breath. This chemical weapons taboo appears to have originated in the innate human aversion to poisonous substances, says Jonathan Tucker, author of A History of Chemical Weapons. Tucker says that established nations also look at such weapons as cowardly and ignoble, as a duplicitous use of poison by the weak to defeat the strong without a fair physical fight. When were chemical weapons banned? As societies became capable of manufacturing large quantities of poison chemicals, there were repeated attempts to make the use of them taboo. In 1874, European nations attending the Brussels Convention on the Rules of War called for, but did not approve, a ban on the employment of poison or poisoned weapons. In 1899, major Western nations participating in the Hague Peace Conference went further, approving an agreement to prohibit the firing of any projectiles, the sole object of which is the diffusion of asphyxiating or deleterious gases. The ban didn't stand long. What happened? World War I. On April 22, 1915, Germany attacked Allied troops outside Ypres, Belgium, with chlorine gas. It was the first time a lethal gas had been used on a large scale in a modern war. Suddenly we saw this yellow wall moving quite slowly towards our lines, recounted Archibald James of the Royal Flying Corps. We hadn't any idea what it was. French soldiers were enveloped by the gas and began choking. Many made the mistake of diving for cover at the bottom of their trenches, where the gas, heavier than air, collected in a lethal cloud. When it was over, British soldier Lyndon Payne said, "The Allied line was absolutely covered with bodies of gassed men. Must have been over 1,000 of them." How did the world react? The Allies saw how effective gases could be and started using them. Both sides went on to use phosgene, a choking agent, and mustard gas, which causes painful burns and blisters. By the end of the Great War, dubbed by historians the Chemist War, more than 90,000 soldiers had been killed by poison gas, many succumbing only after days or weeks of agony. A million more were injured, many blinded for life. The world's horror led the League of Nations in 1925 to draft the Geneva Protocol, banning chemical weapons in war and declaring that their use has been justly condemned by the general opinion of the civilized world. Most nations signed on, though the U.S. did not until 1975. Did the protocol end their use? No, but it effectively stigmatized them so that only rogue nations have used them since. Even the Nazis, who used gas to murder prisoners en masse in concentration camps, never unleashed gases on the battlefield. Still, the Geneva Protocol only banned using chemical weapons in war. It did not prohibit countries from producing and stockpiling them, and countries, including the U.S., did just that for decades, to serve as a deterrent to other nations. Only after the Cold War ended did the U.S. and the Soviet Union sign the Chemical Weapons Convention and begin to slowly incinerate their vast storehouse of chemical weapons. Why did Syria get them? Syria began stockpiling chemical weapons in the 1970s and 80s after losing three consecutive wars to Israel. The Syrians saw chemical weapons, which had been called the poor man's nuclear weapon, as a last resort to counter Israel's military superiority and nuclear arsenal. Syria has been steadily manufacturing chemical weapons ever since. Intelligence services have estimated Syria's stockpile at 1,000 tons of chemical weapons, stashed in 50 facilities. Syria, says former Pentagon official Stephen Bucci, has become the superpower of chemical weapons. With its back against the wall, the regime has proven its willingness to use them. When Saddam was our friend, Saddam Hussein enjoyed U.S. support in his long war with Iran in the 1980s, even after Iraq repeatedly used chemical weapons. Iraq used mustard gas against the Iranians in 1983, with no objection from the Reagan administration. In 1987, Foreign Policy magazine reported last week, the U.S. gave Saddam intelligence that an Iranian invasion was imminent at a hole in Iraq's defenses. An Iranian victory is unacceptable, President Reagan wrote on an intelligence report. In response to the U.S. warning, Saddam repeatedly attacked Iranian forces with sarin, killing more than 20,000 and injuring thousands more. He later used sarin to kill more than 5,000 Kurds to put down an uprising in northern Iraq. Retired Air Force Colonel Rick Francona, who was military attaché in Baghdad during the 1988 attacks, told Foreign Policy that the U.S. chose to ignore Saddam's use of chemical weapons because Iraq was seen as the lesser of two evils. The Iraqis never told us that they intended to use nerve gas, Francona said. They didn't have to. We already knew. And here are the best columns from the U.S. The first comes from Brett Stevens at the Wall Street Journal. What history teaches about isolationism. Do Republicans want to become, again, the party of isolationists? Asked Brett Stevens. Out of general war weariness and a distrust of President Obama, far too many Republican congressmen and senators are echoing Senator Rand Paul's insistence that the war in Syria has no clear national security connection to the United States. Try telling that to Israel, which is anxiously awaiting our response to its sworn enemy's use of chemical weapons, or to Iran's mullahs, who want to know if we'll really stop them from building a nuclear bomb. Republicans now tempted by isolationism ought to consult history, which has not been kind to those who preach that naive philosophy. Senator Robert Taft, the GOP's leading isolationist for decades, in 1939 heatedly blamed the Roosevelt administration for trying to stir up prejudice against Hitler's Germany to take the minds of the people off their trouble at home. Taft later opposed the creation of NATO as an unnecessary provocation of the Soviet Union. Rand Paul may not know it yet, but intellectually speaking, he's already yesterday's man. Republicans follow him at their peril. This from Ginger McCall at the New York Times. when your face reveals your identity. The age of face recognition technology is about to begin, said Ginger McCall, and it may turn all citizens into potential suspects. The government is making fast progress on new surveillance technology that can scan a crowd and identify individuals just by their faces. By cross-referencing databases of driver's license photos, police mugshots, and other photos. Naturally, law enforcement officials are very enthusiastic about face recognition because it can be very useful in detecting or catching terrorists. But the technology also invites abuse, especially if the government is allowed to put all driver's license photos and other available photos into its databases, rather than just the photos of terrorists and criminals. Then virtually everyone could be identified by the government whenever we show our faces in public. Peace protesters, Tea Party marchers, or other dissidents could be quickly identified and tracked, with their activities turned into a secret file. If you don't want law enforcement authorities to determine, behind closed doors, how face recognition is used, you better speak up now. And finally, from Dahlia Lithwick at Slate.com, blaming a teenage rape victim. It was a spectacularly awful week in rape, said Dahlia Lithwick. A Montana judge last week gave a 30-day sentence to a 49-year-old male teacher who engaged in the statutory rape of a troubled 14-year-old student. The girl killed herself after repeatedly having sex with this teacher. This wasn't some forcible, horrible rape, said District Judge G. Todd Baugh, in reducing the teacher's original sentence from 15 years to a mere month. The victim was older than her chronological age, the judge said, and as much in control of the situation as her adult teacher. Though it's hard to believe, Baugh's insistence that teen temptresses bear responsibility for seducing men is becoming fashionable once again. Indeed, some people are even arguing that rape laws are too tough on men and that consensual sex between teachers and flirtatious students shouldn't be a crime. But society prohibited sex with underage students for a reason: the huge power imbalance between students and teachers. In the Montana case, the teacher's exploitation of a vulnerable student led to her suicide. If a judge can't make the right decision in a case like this, then it's really time to worry. This from the business section. Family, caring for aging parents. Taking care of an aging relative can be costly in more ways than one, said Ann Cairns in the New York Times. Nearly 40% of Americans today are caring for someone with a serious health issue, up from 30% in 2010, according to a new Pew Research Center study. Those caretakers are likely to report poor health themselves and to shortchange their own financial future. The Federal Family and Medical Leave Act requires certain types of employers to grant unpaid personal leave, but its 12-week annual limit offers little help to those dealing with the chronic needs of an elderly person. The average caregiver, if she leaves the workforce, will lose more than $324,000 in wages and Social Security and pension benefits. If you expect to care for an aging parent one day, start planning now, says Juliet Fairley in MainStreet.com. Your employer may offer a legal benefit package that gives you affordable access to patient advocates who can help you put together a strategy. Make sure you have a full picture of your parents' financial and legal situation, including where any financial documents are stored. Have them equip you with the power of attorney so you can make financial or medical decisions on their behalf. And you should encourage them to prepare an advance directive that outlines a person's wishes about medical and life-sustaining procedures. "These are touchy topics," said Sally Herigstad in Bankrate.com. "It takes time and sensitivity to make your parents' finances something you can talk about comfortably. If you have siblings, enlist their aid. It's helpful to have two or more people trying to talk to the parent about money not lasting forever and the importance of watching expenses. If your parents have any financial contacts, such as accountants, landlords, or tenants, get to know them. Be prepared to step in at the first sign of trouble, but remember to be respectful and keep your parents involved as long as possible." "Your approach is crucial," said Carolyn Rosenblatt in Forbes.com. "Elders often have an attitude of secrecy about their financial situation, so getting them to open up can be a challenge. Instead of exacerbating their fears of losing control over their lives, make the process about yourself. Tell them you're concerned that if something went wrong, you would be completely lost as to how to help them. The main thing is not to wait until you need a lawyer to get a court order for guardianship. Start early. You'll be glad you did." The issue of the week: the state of American labor. "Can we quit glorifying labor already?" said Kevin D. Williamson in NationalReview.com. "Every year we take off the first Monday in September, fire up the grill, and put on some hot dogs in a crypto-communist celebration of the working class. We do so despite the obvious fact that labor is no longer a class. It's a racket. Don't fall for the Democrats' tired Labor Day speeches dripping with false pathos. The main problem of the poor in the United States is not that they are worked too hard, but that they do not work at all. The Republicans should grasp this holiday as an occasion to talk about government-promoted unemployment and union excesses. Patriotic bunting is no substitute for an agenda." "Labor Day wasn't always about the hot dogs," said Paul Krugman in the New York Times. "It was a show of respect for workers. And it's amazing how conservatives have flipped the script. They fetishize corporations and small businesses, yet ignore the plight of ordinary Americans who are paid lousy wages or laid off to pad profits, disdaining them as takers rather than makers. Many of these so-called takers work hard trying to make ends meet. If they need some help from the government, the past few decades of soaring economic inequality almost certainly have something to do with it. We have to face the fact that many Americans these days find that no matter how hard they work, they can't afford the basics of a middle-class existence. They can't be too picky either," said Robert J. Samuelson in the Washington Post. "Employers have the upper hand in today's economy, and the advantage shows few signs of ending. Unemployment is shrinking, but slowly, and wage growth remains sluggish at best. Union protections and private pensions are vanishing, though at least the public safety net, unemployment insurance, Social Security, anti-poverty programs, anti-discrimination laws, remains. Career jobs are a thing of the past, meaning that only the most talented, competitive, and entrepreneurial employees excel. History shows that workers get higher wages in periods of strong growth and tight markets. On Labor Day 2013, this prospect is nowhere in sight." "Wages aren't the main problem," said Peggy Noonan in the Wall Street Journal. "Work, after all, isn't just about collecting a paycheck. It gives us purpose, stability, integration, shared mission. And so to be unable to work, unable to find or hold a job, is a kind of catastrophe for a human being. In the United States, 11.5 million people are currently experiencing that catastrophe, not counting those who are underemployed or have stopped looking for work altogether. They are so tragically numerous because we lack politicians who can help jobs happen, who can advance and support the kind of national policies that encourage American genius. A zest for innovation still lurks in the American character, but we need a political leader who can stoke it back to life. Someone with real passion about the idea of new businesses, new inventions, growth, productivity, breakthroughs, and jobs, jobs, jobs. Our last word article this week is called The Facilitator. Edward Snowden's revelations are making news, said Peter Moss, but the woman who enabled them isn't. This past January, Laura Poitras received a curious email from an anonymous stranger requesting her public encryption key. For almost 2 years, Poitras had been working on a documentary about surveillance, and she occasionally received queries from strangers. She replied to this one and sent her public key, allowing him or her to send an encrypted email that only Poitras could open with her private key. But she didn't think much would come of it. The stranger responded with instructions for creating an even more secure system to protect their exchanges. Before long, Poitras received an encrypted message that outlined a number of secret surveillance programs run by the government. She had heard of one of them, but not the others. After describing each program, the stranger wrote some version of the phrase, "This I can prove." Seconds after she decrypted and read the email, Poitras disconnected from the internet and removed the message from her computer. I thought, okay, if this is true, my life just changed, she told me in July. It was staggering what he claimed to know and be able to provide. Poitras did not know the stranger's name, sex, age, or employer. CIA, NSA, Pentagon? In early June, she finally got the answer. Along with her reporting partner, Glenn Greenwald, the former lawyer and a columnist for The Guardian, Poitras flew to Hong Kong and met with the NSA contractor, Edward J. Snowden, who gave them thousands of classified documents, setting off a major controversy over the extent and legality of government surveillance. Poitras was right that, among other things, her life would never be the same. Poitras has shared the byline on some of Greenwald's articles, but for the most part she has preferred to stay in the background. As a result, Greenwald is the one hailed as either a fearless defender of individual rights or a nefarious traitor, depending on your perspective. I keep calling her the Kaiser Soze of the story, because she's at once completely invisible and yet ubiquitous, Greenwald said, referring to the character in The Usual Suspects, played by Kevin Spacey, a mastermind masquerading as a nobody. She's been at the center of all of this, and yet no one knows anything about her. She was raised in a well-off family outside Boston, and after high school she moved to San Francisco to work as a chef. She also studied under the experimental filmmaker Ernie Gehr. Since then, she has made 5 films, most recently The Oath, about the Guantanamo prisoner Salim Hamdan and his brother-in-law back in Yemen, and has been the recipient of a Peabody Award and a MacArthur Award. On September 11, 2001, Poitras was on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. Like most New Yorkers, in the weeks that followed, she was swept up in both mourning and a feeling of unity. It was a moment, she said, when people could have done anything, in a positive sense. When that moment led to the preemptive invasion of Iraq, she felt that her country had lost its way. We always wonder how countries can veer off course, she said. How do people let it happen? In June 2004, she went to Iraq and began documenting the occupation. Shortly after arriving in Baghdad, she received permission to go to Abu Ghraib prison to film a visit by members of Baghdad City Council. This was just a few months after photos were published of American soldiers abusing prisoners there. A Sunni doctor was part of the visiting delegation, and Poitras shot a remarkable scene of his interaction with the prisoners there, shouting that they were locked up for no good reason. The doctor, Riyad A. Adhad, invited Poitras to his clinic and later allowed her to report on his life in Baghdad. Her documentary, My Country, My Country, is centered on his family's travails, the shootings and blackouts in their neighborhood, the kidnapping of a nephew. The film premiered in early 2006 and received widespread acclaim. Attempting to tell the story of the war's effect on Iraqi citizens made Poitras the target of serious and apparently false accusations. On November 19, 2004, Iraqi troops, supported by American forces, raided a mosque in the doctor's neighborhood, killing several people inside. The next day, the neighborhood erupted in violence. Poitras was with the doctor's family, and occasionally they would go to the roof of the home to get a sense of what was going on. On one of those rooftop visits, she was seen by American soldiers. Shortly after, a group of insurgents launched an attack that killed one of the Americans. Some soldiers speculated that Poitras was on the roof because she had advanced notice of the attack and wanted to film it. There's no evidence to support this claim. Fighting occurred throughout the neighborhood that day, so it would have been difficult for any journalist to not be near the site of an attack. The soldiers who made the allegation told me that they have no evidence to prove it. Although the allegations were without evidence, they may be related to Poitras' many detentions and searches. She was detained for the first time at Newark International Airport before boarding a flight to Israel, where she was showing her film. On her return flight, she was held for 2 hours before being allowed to re-enter the country. The next month, she traveled to Bosnia to show the film at a festival there. When she flew out of Sarajevo and landed in Vienna, she was paged at the airport loudspeaker, and told to go to a security desk. "They took my bags and checked them," Poitras said, "and then I sort of befriended the security guy. I asked what was going on. He said, 'You're flagged. You have a threat score that is off the Richter scale. You're at a 400 out of 400. I said, "Is this a scoring system that works throughout all of Europe? Or is this an American scoring system?" He said, "No, this is your government that has this and has told us to stop you." It is a routine that has happened so many times since then, on more than 40 occasions, that she has lost precise count. Poitras endured the airport searches for years with little public complaint, lest her protests generate more suspicion and hostility from the government. But last year she reached a breaking point. While being interrogated at Newark, she was told she could not take notes. On the advice of lawyers, Poitras had always recorded the names of the border agents and the questions they asked and the material they copied or seized. But at Newark, an agent threatened to handcuff her if she continued writing. She was told that she was being barred from writing anything down because she might use her pen as a weapon. "It went on for maybe an hour and a half," she said. "I was taking notes of their questions, or trying to, and they yelled at me. I said, 'Show me the law where it says I can't take notes.'" Poitras met Greenwald in 2010, when she became interested in his work on WikiLeaks. He was aware of the searches and asked several times for permission to write about them. After Newark, she gave him a green light. His article was published in April 2012. Shortly after it was posted, the detention ceased. 6 years of surveillance and harassment, Poitras hoped, might be coming to an end. Snowden had read Greenwald's article about Poitras' troubles at U.S. airports and knew she was making a film about the government's surveillance programs. He figured that she would understand the programs he wanted to leak about and would know how to communicate in a secure way. Snowden told her early on that she would need to work with someone else and that she should reach out to Greenwald. Snowden began to provide documents to the two of them. He also said he would soon be ready to meet them. This May, he sent encrypted messages telling the two of them to go to Hong Kong. Greenwald flew to New York from Rio, and Poitras joined him for meetings with the editor of The Guardian's American edition. With the paper's reputation on the line, the editor asked them to bring along a veteran Guardian reporter, Ewan McCaskill, and on June 1st, the trio boarded a 16-hour flight to Hong Kong. Snowden had sent a small number of documents to Greenwald, but Poitras had received the larger trove. On the plane, Greenwald began going through its contents, eventually coming across a secret court order requiring Verizon to give its customer phone records to the NSA. The four-page order was from the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, a panel whose decisions are highly classified. Although it was rumored that the NSA was collecting large numbers of American phone records, the government always denied it. Greenwald pointed to the FISA order on his screen and asked Poitras, "Have you seen this? Is this saying what I'm thinking it's saying?" "We couldn't believe just how momentous this occasion was," Greenwald said. "When you read these documents, you get a sense of the breadth of them. It was a rush of adrenaline and ecstasy and elation. You feel you are empowered for the first time because there's this mammoth system that you try and undermine and subvert and shine a light on, but you usually can't make any headway because you don't have any instruments to do it. And now, the instruments were suddenly in our lap." In Hong Kong, they met Snowden and went to his room, where Poitras immediately shifted into documentarian mode. Taking her camera out, Greenwald began questioning. "I wanted to test the consistency of his claims, and I wanted all the information I could get, given how much I knew this was going to be affecting my credibility and everything else. We weren't really able to establish a human bond until after that 5 or 6 hours was over." For the next week, the preparations followed a similar pattern. When they entered Snowden's room, they would remove their cell phone batteries and place them on the refrigerator of Snowden's minibar. They lined pillows against the door to discourage eavesdropping from outside. Then Poitras set up her camera and filmed. It was important to Snowden to explain to them how the government's intelligent machinery worked because he feared that he could be arrested at any time. Greenwald's first articles, including the initial one detailing the Verizon order, appeared while they were still in the process of interviewing Snowden. It made for a strange experience, creating the news together, then watching it spread. "We could see it being covered," Poitras said. "We were all surprised at how much attention it was getting. Our work was very focused, and we were paying attention to that. But we could see on TV that it was taking off." In an encrypted chat, Snowden explained to me why he went to Poitras with his secrets. "Laura and Glenn are among the few who reported fearlessly on controversial topics throughout this period, even in the face of withering personal criticism, which resulted in Laura specifically becoming targeted by the very programs involved in the recent disclosures. She had demonstrated the courage, personal experience, and skill needed to handle what is probably the most dangerous assignment any journalist can be given: reporting on the secret misdeeds of the most powerful government in the world, making her an obvious choice. This was adapted from a piece that originally appeared in the New York Times Magazine. Take a look now at the health and science section. A genetic guide to true happiness. Human beings appear to be genetically engineered to be the happiest and healthiest when we spend a lot of time selflessly helping others, and unhealthy when we're mostly devoted to self-gratification. That's the eye-opening conclusion of the University of North Carolina researchers, based on a study of 80 volunteers. The study subjects were asked how often they felt hedonic pleasure, the kind of happiness brought about by enjoying a tasty meal or buying something. They were also asked how often they contributed something important to society that gave them a deeper sense of purpose. The researchers then drew the subject's blood and found that the genes of the volunteers whose lives contained lots of pleasure but little meaning, were priming cells to express high levels of inflammation, which is linked to cancer, diabetes, and cardiovascular disease, and a weaker antiviral response to infections. Their daily activities provide short-term happiness, yet result in negative physical consequences long-term, psychophysiologist Barbara Fredrickson tells ScienceDaily.com. People who emphasize service to others and a connection to community, on the other hand, showed a pattern of gene expression linked to less inflammation and stronger immunity. There are two distinct kinds of happiness, said study co-author Stephen Cole, and our genes can tell the difference. Why wolves howl? When wolves let loose with their lonely-sounding howls, they are actually expressing loneliness rather than acting on pure instinct, as researchers long thought. That's the conclusion of animal behaviorists at the University of Veterinary Medicine in Vienna, who experimented with members of a captive wolf pack by taking each member of the pack out for a walk, one at a time, and observing the howls of the wolves left behind while testing their levels of the stress hormone cortisol. They found that all of the wolves howled and showed signs of stress when the pack leader left their sight. But the wolves also howled particularly long during the absence of the preferred partners that they play with, groom, and lie close to when sleeping, study author Friedrich Range tells ScienceMag.org. Those howls, it seems, were a way of asking for companionship, rather than pure expressions of stress. Social relationships are very important to them, Range said, and the howling patterns reflect that. I couldn't resist this short piece from the section called It Must Be True. I read it in the tabloids. A Washington State man was arrested after he allegedly strapped a bag of marijuana to an arrow and shot it into a prison. Authorities said that David Wayne Jordan tried to shoot the arrow into the exercise yard at the Whatcom County Jail, but overshot the target, with his special delivery landing on a roof. When Jordan, 36, was arrested, he claimed he'd been trying to hit a squirrel. He had no explanation as to why squirrel hunting requires attaching marijuana to an arrow, said Sheriff Bill Elfo. And on that note, we have a Talking Points article titled Marijuana, the Feds Mellow Out. The war on drugs may have ended, said Maya Solovitz in Time.com. Last week, U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder told federal prosecutors to no longer enforce federal marijuana laws in Colorado and Washington. the first states to legalize recreational marijuana. The Justice Department's decision is the first profound crack in the federal edifice of drug prohibition since President Nixon declared war on drugs in 1971, and may accelerate the decisions of six other states that are moving toward referendums on legalizing weed: Arizona, California, Maine, Massachusetts, Montana, and Nevada. "It is without doubt good news for the stoner set," said Winston Ross in thedailybeast.com. For the past 10 months, marijuana businesses have been operating nervously in Colorado and Washington, dealing only in cash and with a wary lookout for a raid by federal agents. Now there's more legal clarity. Both consumers and sellers in those states can chill. "Count me out of the celebration," said Charles C.W. Cook in NationalReview.com. "There's no doubt that the war on drugs has been an abject failure. Our prisons hold 100,000 Americans on marijuana offenses, mostly small scale, at a cost of $15 billion a year, with no resulting drop in marijuana use. Clearly, the federal government should never have banned pot in the first place. But it did, and it's the constitutional duty of the executive branch to execute the laws, not to pick and choose the ones which it wishes to adhere, If Colorado and Washington can effectively nullify marijuana prohibition, then why can't Missouri get away with its new bill nullifying federal gun regulations? That the president cares more about one than the other is not a good enough answer. Besides, Holder's decision provides no firm guarantee to weed dealers," said Harry Cheadle in Vice.com. He said the feds could still bust anyone selling weed to minors or who's involved in large criminal enterprises, meaning that federal prosecutors remain free to use their sometimes fickle judgment. "Still, there's no doubt that the country has reached a turning point," said Steve Chapman in Chicago Tribune. 16 states have decriminalized possession of small amounts of marijuana, with no sudden surge of drug abuse, by fully legalizing weed. Washington and Colorado will serve as laboratories of democracy for other states to study. Step by step, the U.S. is moving away from a failed policy of prohibition. Education. Is it immoral to go private? "You are a bad person if you send your child to private school," said Allison Benedict in Slate.com. I know. Parents send kids to private schools because they live in urban areas with bad schools, or because their kids are gifted or have learning issues, or simply because they want small classes and personal attention and courses in modern film and Mandarin. You know who else wants those things? Everyone. And when middle-class and affluent parents pull their kids out of public schools, it effectively guarantees that those schools will never have the clout or resources they deserve. If everyone were invested in public schools, not just property tax invested, but flesh and blood offspring invested, these schools would begin to improve. Rather than run from the schools that the poor families are forced to depend on, send your kids to school with their kids, and then fight to make things better for everyone. "This is the educational equivalent of Soviet economics," said Rod Dreher in theamericanconservative.com. "Am I really supposed to believe that I have a moral obligation to give my kids a crappy education when I know something better and higher is available to them, either from private, parochial, or homeschool? For liberals, all that matters is that we are united in the state, no matter how stupid, ignorant, and poor it makes us." Benedict is also mistaken about her basic premise, said John Carney in CNBC.com. "Competition improves education, and numerous studies show that when public high schools have to compete with private schools, they raise their game in every way. So parents who send their kids to private schools aren't bad people. They are performing a verifiable public good." Private schools serve another important function, said Megan McArdle in Bloomberg.com. They keep affluent families from fleeing cities. In some urban areas, schools are war zones with crime and violence, and not even guilty liberals are going to keep kids in schools where they're beaten up. If you couldn't send your kid to a private school, you'd just move. That's what happened to Detroit and the Bronx and parts of Chicago, leaving those communities in ruin. Parents have a primal instinct to give their kids the best possible chance to succeed. Any solution that ignores human nature will never work. And a few notes as we wind down. Even though the U.S. has been involved in more than a dozen military conflicts over the past 70 years, Congress has not formally declared war on any country since June 5, 1942, when it signed off on military action against Nazi Germany's allies Bulgaria, Hungary, and Romania. The percentage of U.S. companies that offer their employees health insurance has declined from 66% to 57% in the last decade. That trend is expected to continue as the Affordable Care Act promotes insurance outside employment. Squirrels have caused more than 50 power outages this summer in 24 states, affecting tens of thousands of utility customers. Squirrels cause the blackouts by chewing through wires or connecting an energized component with a grounded one, connecting a circuit and causing a small explosion. And a quote from Richard Branson from themotleyfool.com. It's easy to become a millionaire. Start out as a billionaire and then buy an airline. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Services wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast will be available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time.